and welcome to the House of Comments podcast. My name is Emma Burnell and I'm a Labour blogger. I blog at the Scarlet Standard and Labour List. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Helen Lewis, who is Deputy Editor of the New Statesman. Hi, Helen.
Hello.
And Isabel Hardman, who is Assistant Editor of The Spectator. Hi, Isabel.
Hello.
Lovely. So we thought we'd launch straight into it with obviously the key political event, if not of the weekend, then of the year, possibly even the decade. It's been the Lib Dem Spring Conference. Were either of you there today, Helen, Isabel?
No.
Tragically not.
I haven't seen much coverage of it, which I think tells a story in and of itself. Outside of Twitter, it doesn't seem to have caught the imagination of the populace. But as I understand it, we're all patriots now, is the basic message. Helen?
Yeah, even...
Oh, sorry.
I think it's funny. Apparently Nick Clegg did one of his Hugh Grant in Love Actually speeches where he sort of talked about steam railways and big pies and you know, the smell of grass in the morning and stuff like that. But no, there's been two kind of interesting lines that I think have come out of it. And those are basically Europe and immigration. And both of them were seeing a really aggressive differentiation strategy from the Lib Dems. Now, this worries me slightly because it's all very well for them to differentiate themselves from the Tories, but they've got to govern with them in a coalition for another 14 months. And I think we're all going to be heartily sick of this quite soon.
Isabel, do you concur or are you already heartily sick?
I'm actually heartily bored of the way the coalition's working now or not working. The Lib Dems, I think when you're a journalist, you like rows, but you like rows that are real rather than ones that someone has planned to have in a very manufactured way, which is essentially what Lib Dems and the Tories are having at the moment. It's almost as though Nick Clegg has this grid of rows where he sort of decides that next week we're going to argue about energy. And that's quite frustrating. Some people might say that actually legislating less is a good thing, but both parties feel that there are many more reforms they'd like to do, but they can't agree on them. And so we have a year basically of people sniping at one another in an incredibly synthetic way until we get to the general election, which I don't think is a particularly good way of governing or particularly enjoyable.
And I think, Isabel, you were saying on Westminster yesterday, a week in Westminster yesterday, that you know the MPs are just kind of rattling around the Commons looking at a bit of a loose end, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're having many opposition day debates, which obviously is great for Labour because they can raise every issue that is dear to them. But they then vote on motions which are not binding at all on the government. So they're having these endless debates on housing policy and that sort of thing, which no one goes to because they're opposition day debates. Then they have a vote which tells the government it's rubbish and the government ignores it, which again is not a great use of the Commons. And the legislation that is going through, for instance, the immigration bill, is being pushed through in a very small amount of time, even though there's a huge amount of Commons time that could be used to scrutinise it properly.
That seems to have been quite a theme. I mean, lots of bills going through very quickly. Do you think that's because there's so much disagreement or so many spaces that they're looking to synthetically disagree, but where they actually need to vote their own legislation through, that in fact too much parliamentary time just exposes the divisions, the real ones?
I think too much parliamentary time for... it's actually more of a problem for internal Conservative politics than it is for coalition politics, because I suppose once they've agreed on a bill, at least the Conservatives and the Lib Dems are signed up to it. And then what happens is Conservative MPs get very upset, as they did with the immigration bill, and rebel. So the less time you give a bill, the fewer rebellions they can have, because ministers can simply talk the additional amendments out at report stage.
And is the... I mean, as we are approaching the election, will the parties internally start behaving a little bit more, because certainly in the Conservative Party in particular has had a very rowdy 4 years and doesn't show many signs of calming that down as we run up to the election.
I think there's a real danger for Labour that it's looking quite unified at the moment. You know, those trade union reforms, which we all thought were going to collapse into a kind of vicious round of backstabbing and knifing and Len McCluskey asking for his ball back, have so far been kind of quite well managed by Ed Miliband. But the problem comes that at some point they've got to put out a proper manifesto. And at the moment, they've got two very different things to match up. So there's Ebbles' commitment to the overall sort of spending envelope and, you know, and the benefit changes that the coalition have put through, which is going to require some really tight fiscal discipline. And then there's the side of some goodies to appeal to the kind of Labour heartlands and to appeal to people like Len McCluskey, who now have got more control because they're in charge of the union's political funds. So that's going to be a really difficult balancing act. And I think that could threaten Labour unity, certainly.
I think Conservatives are pulling together a bit more. You see Tories who were sort of troublemakers actually being really on message. So I always think of Stuart Jackson, who was really very, very open about his dislike of the leadership a year ago. Just after the Eastleigh by-election, he was saying, you know, this is all the fault of the gay marriage bill and the party isn't paying enough attention to concerns on immigration, all that sort of thing. He's actually really pulled behind the leadership now, and has even been defending James Brokenshire for his disastrous speech.
I think that is a real act of
That's loyalty, isn't it?
That really is loyal. I think we'll get on to the immigration issue in a bit, but yes, that certainly is loyal, particularly if Stuart has a nanny or a... I think you're right. I mean, we've drifted away a little bit from Lib Dem conference. If I could bring it back to the Liberal Democrats, I think what's interesting with them is that they have actually shown a lot of unity and discipline overall. And where they haven't, it's been little incursions. I'm thinking particularly from Tim Farron, who's been making a lot of manoeuvres over the last week or so, on the bedroom tax and other issues.
I always think when you come to Tim Farron that we talk a lot about the kind of, you know, strategy of differentiation. I think there's a strategy of differentiation going on within the Lib Dems.
Yes.
And I think that you have to know, you know, that Tim Farron as party president, he, like you say, he rebelled on the bedroom tax. He's got the kind of license to throw a few bits of red meat to the left of the party, who otherwise might feel quite poorly served. But yeah, in terms of unity from the Lib Dems, I mean, it all comes back to the fact that they, you know, their hands were dipped in blood over the coalition agreement. You know, they signed up to this, and you saw at their autumn conference last year that, you know, austerity and deficit reduction, they have swallowed that, that is something that they're going to have their name attached to, and they've made peace with that in a way that perhaps the Tories, who still feel slightly disgruntled and like they shouldn't have this kind of, you know, yellow bird hanging around their neck, have never quite come to terms with.
Isabel, if there were to be another coalition in 2015, do you think that the Tories would be better served if they let their members vote for it in the same way the Lib Dems did?
I think they would, in terms of making sure there was buy-in for the coalition, as Helen says. But the risk there is that if they let them have a secret ballot, if they let MPs have a secret ballot, which is what MPs want, then there are a number of ministers who I know who would vote against a coalition and would rather have a minority government, partly because they've had pretty bruising experience of dealing with the Lib Dems and they'd actually rather have a minority government. So it could be the case that the coalition is approved, but with a hefty number of Conservative MPs voting against, which sort of undermines it from the very start.
And as Isabel says, it's not only ministers. There's a whole kind of generation of white male 30 and 40 something Conservatives who know that they're never going to get a sniff of anything like promotion if there's a coalition, because there will have to be some, you know, there'll be Lib Dems in the slots that would have gone to them, and the Tories have got to be much more careful about who they put in at different levels. So yeah, I think that'll be the thing. It would be funny if they decided to do that as a kind of reconcile everybody to the coalition, and then the answer was, well, we'd no, in fact, we're not reconciled to coalition, we don't want you, bugger off.
Absolutely, and I think there would be the same issue if you put it to the Labour membership, possibly even more so because of the vitriol that exists between Labour and the Lib Dems. I can't imagine many people I know as activists actively voting to go into coalition with the Lib Dems, despite the fact that the other answer is, well, the Tories probably get in.
I suppose also I think minority government is appealing both to Labour and the Tories if they do end up being the largest party. But it's more difficult nowadays because MPs are just much more independent. It's cool to rebel these days and you listen to your constituents more, and that's sort of the way MPs feel they can afford an identity for themselves. So 10, 20 years ago, actually, you could do minority government. I'm not sure it would be that easy nowadays, because you wouldn't just be patching deals with other parties for every single bill and every single vote. You'd have to patch deals with your own party, and that would be exhausting.
Mm. And we might end up in the situation, as you say, we're in now, where there's very little legislation that's actually going through because the party managers just don't feel that they could get it through.
Yeah, well, and you exactly. might end up in a situation that would not, I don't think any of the parties would want, where you had a minority government that didn't last for very long and a second election was called. And that's something that I think terrifies all the parties in different ways. None of them are really awash with cash. Mm. The Lib Dems are certainly in a lot of trouble. Labour, as I say, they've lost the historic link with the unions in one sense, so they're not feeling particularly flush either.
So, speaking of differentiation and splits, this week there was a speech that possibly united many of us, but though probably not quite in the way the writer of the speech would have wanted. James Brokenshire of the Tories gave a speech on immigration where he blamed rich people with foreign nannies largely for the problem that the Tories seem to have with getting immigration numbers down. That, of course, immediately led the press on a tour of exactly how many Tory ministers employed foreign nannies, gardeners, etc. Isabel, do we have a number yet?
Oh, I don't know, but my favourite one so far has been Danny Alexander's answer on the Today programme, where he was asked whether he employed any foreign staff, and he went, we have a British nanny and a Portuguese cleaner who comes in occasionally. So that was something to be really ashamed of.
I'm just waiting for someone to ask, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg, and for him to go, actually, my butlers from the Dominican Republic, and my chauffeurs from Gibraltar. Isabel will remember this better than me, but do you remember a similarly disastrous intervention, perhaps even under the last government, about middle class people who pay their cleaners in cash are responsible for
that? Was
water.
David Gawke. Yeah.
There we go. It just never goes well when you do one of these kind of morality police things in the middle class, because it inevitably turns out that several of your colleagues have fallen foul of it, because, you know, no one's perfect. And, you know, I just think it's funny that Gordon Brown must have been the only person in the world who played National Insurance on his cleaner, and had it all perfectly kind of set up and above board. But, you know, lots of people do this. It's not something that it really behoves ministers to get on their high horse about, because they can't really.
It's also just a sign of kind of powerlessness of ministers when they start lecturing people for doing something which is perfectly legal. That's when you sort of think, well, isn't it your job to change things so that we're in a sort of better situation? If you have a problem with what someone's doing and it's legal, then you shouldn't lecture them. You should change the law if you've got such a problem. It's the same with, you know, tax avoidance. Ministers lecture people for doing what is perfectly legal. And it's actually their job to change the tax regime so that there's less tax avoidance. I always find it slightly baffling that, you know, ministers aren't. I know Parliament looks a bit like a church, but they're not actually vicars. They're not there to kind of moralise to us about how to live our lives.
Yes, if you're so terrified about people at the BBC for turning themselves into limited companies and then paying themselves dividends, then if only there were some class of people who had the ability to change that law. But yeah.
No, absolutely. And it does seem that immigration on a wider scale is one of these areas where the Lib Dems and the Tories are quite happy to go into differentiation mode that suits both of them and their constituencies. Is that why this was blown up?
Well, I think the problem with immigration is that nobody can tell the truth. So the problem is that voters really hate immigration. It consistently comes up as one of the top concerns. You know, one of the people that really, when people talk about worries about Europe, they're often talking about it as a proxy for immigration. But on the other hand, the bold fact is that actually immigration is really good for growth. It's really good for the economy to have free movement of labour. It's one of the things that's helped Britain become the country that it has. So you have this terrible problem where, you know, it's a really popular thing to do to bash immigration, but it slightly feeds into to xenophobia, and it's sometimes more blatantly than others, as with UKIP edging towards that kind of, you know, I don't hear any British people on the train anymore kind of line. And also then you get, you know, James Brokenshire got roasted by the Institute of Directors for being, I can't remember, Isabel, what was the words? It was petty and pathetic. So there's you know, business really wants immigration. It's a huge asset to them, as is being part of the single market in Europe. So the Tories, who are the party of business, find themselves on the wrong side of that argument. Labour, who are supposed to be the progressive party that are in no way kind of feeding into any kind of even, you know, taint of racism, find themselves on the wrong side of that. And there's this kind of huge swell of cognitive dissonance, basically, about it.
Yeah.
And it just shows how rubbish politicians are at dealing with immigration, that they've been rubbish at dealing with it for years and talking about it properly. But when they decide to deal with it, they deal with it in an even more rubbish way. It sort of wonder whether there was any point in them actually trying to deal with it in the first place, in terms of addressing public fears. So I don't think what James Brokenshire said this week has reassured anybody.
No, absolutely. I mean, the idea that, and we've spent at least 2 years, possibly a lot longer, saying, why don't we ever talk about immigration? We never talk about immigration. Let's talk about immigration. Now we've talked about immigration, everyone gone, oh, shut up. That's so embarrassing.
But it's also really bad in terms of our relationship with Europe. I mean, I think my colleague Raphael Baer made this point in his column a couple of weeks ago, that it's all very well to lead these kind of great Jeremiads against Polish and Romanian and Bulgarian workers. But when it comes to the treaty renegotiation and the concessions that David Cameron wants in Europe, he's going to need the votes of those people. He's also going to need the vote of François Hollande. So it might be very funny to go like, ha, 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 we took you for a rubbish pub lunch and then everyone laughed at you and your approval ratings. But that's not going to do him any favours when he comes to try and want a favour from François Hollande.
Yeah, and I think Angela Merkel made it pretty clear where she stands on those issues when she came over last time.
At least she got a decent lunch out of it. She didn't have to have sort of bangers and mash. And, No, I know, but then and then there was a whole kind of like, oh, we've asked him about his affair, ha, ha, we're amazing. But yeah. That's a rant for another time.
Are we going to get anywhere with the immigration bill, Isabel? Is this going to change anything?
I think most of the things in the immigration bill were ministers trying to deal with things that people think are happening, but which aren't. So benefit tourism, for instance, it's not the issue with immigration at all, but it's one of the few things that they can address. Regardless of what you think of the principle of freedom of movement in the EU, that's here to stay, and it's something that ministers can do nothing about. So to a certain extent, faffing about with benefit tourism, which represents, well, I'm not sure what the figures are, but they're like 3% or maybe 0.3%, but faffing about with that is all they can really do to look as though they're tackling problems with immigration. So in terms of what it changes, not very much, but it makes them look as though they're doing something, which is all they can really do.
Is that true? I mean, my concern is that they do these things where they faff around the edges, and then that feeds the anti-immigration rhetoric, but doesn't actually do anything to change people's perception of there being too many immigrants. So all that happens is we continue to feed the narrative without actually doing, without either, you know, making a decision to become a closed country, which I think would be an appallingly stupid decision, or just saying, actually, the narrative is wrong, we need to change it. But just by playing around in the shallows, isn't that the worst of both worlds?
I mean, I think the problem is that it's much easier to talk about benefit tourism than it is to do things which are sort of long-term reforms to education and the welfare system, which make it easier for British people to compete with migrants. I think that's probably the kind of the thing that politicians should really do. But it's much easier and snappier to bring out a bill that sounds tough and makes landlords check people's documents.
But there is exactly that problem that you mentioned, Emma, which is the problem that if you talk about something to make yourself look tough, like I'm challenging the curse of people using the NHS and blah, 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 and then you see the public opinion polling on it, people think that drastically overestimate what kind of length of a public, what kind of size of a problem that is. I think there was the poll last year, I think it was a ComRes poll, where people thought that something like 12% of Britain was Muslim, because they'd heard so many rows about halal meat, about wearing the veil in public. And, you know, it's really a tiny numbers of people that those issues affect, but they're blown up into being huge issues. And therefore, it's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. So they do become a huge issue.
I mean, and I think we've seen that with a number of issues that politicians avoided for a very long time and now can't stop talking about how they used to avoid.
Well, the flip side of that is that there are some issues that are just simply too large and scary to ever get talked about. And I think, you know, the classic example of this is pensions. I mean, if you ever look at, you know, what our pension liabilities are and whether or not there are going to be enough people of the working age population to support, you know, the number of pensioners we're going to have in 20 or 30 years, you would just sit there and scream quietly to yourself. And therefore, if you're in government for 5 years, then you just sort of probably someone looks at it, has a bit of a quiet scream, and then puts it back in the drawer again quietly. And like, we'll leave that for the next lot of people to look after. So yeah, there's a very distorting prism through which issues are kind of assigned their seriousness.
Yeah, I'm fairly convinced that I'm going to end up with my pension like Yusarian in Catch 22. Every time I get to the right age, they'll move it on another 5 years. Isabel, what's the big issue that you don't think is being talked about properly?
It's similar to Helen, probably pensions, but also probably the long-term future of the NHS as well. It's the kind of thing that gets raised by people who say, oh, we need to charge for this, or we need to, you know, I don't know, stop people who smoke coming on the NHS or something like that. But it's not really discussed properly because it's just so sort of frightening to a certain extent. How are we going to fund the NHS when we do have an ageing population, when people are living for longer but with more complex needs? And how do we deal with that? Do we sacrifice some services? That's the kind of thing that people get very scared of, partly because there's no nice answer that's got sort of motherhood and apple pie written all over it. You can talk about social care and make it sound nice because you're sort of trying to address a long-term problem. But actually, when you get down to the long-term funding of the NHS in general, that's when politicians start to go, we can't really talk about that, and, you know, change the subject to immigration or something like that.
Yeah, and you're right. And for the Tories, it's a toxic issue anyway, because there is a kind of general perception hanging around that what Tory governments want to do is kind of brutally slash public services for ideological reasons. But it's no better for Labour. I mean, there is no acknowledgement that, you know, for all that Andy Burnham's plans to integrate health and social care, there would still have to be hospital closures under a Labour government. There wouldn't be, you know, in perpetuity, free at the point of delivery, you know, service, everything you want coming out of, you know, all the cancer drugs that are the most high end and spec and cost hundreds of thousands of pounds. But yeah, exactly as Isabel says, no one wants to say that because it's not going to win you any votes to tell people that their lives are going to become incrementally worse.
The other thing that no one will say is that actually a genuinely successful health service shuts hospitals because they're not needed. If we had a health service that was better at early intervention, we wouldn't need nearly so much crisis care.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. But again, it's a complicated political argument, and the Tories know that they're very weak on it, and Labour know that they're very strong on it, but know that the less they say about it, the stronger they look.
Yes, let's do everything in headlines. It seems to have worked so far. So speaking of incredibly complicated issues that I and find very difficult to understand, I don't think we can avoid talking about what's happening in the Ukraine at the moment and in Crimea. Obviously, there's been movement between Russian troops. The Ukrainian troops are on red alert, as I understand it. And the international community are condemning Putin. There may be some sanctions, but we're not entirely sure where and how the international diplomacy is taking place. Helen, have you been following this closely?
I've been following it as closely as somebody with no expertise in the region can be expected to, I think. And I think the thing that comes across most strongly is that just as you get banks who are too big to fail, so there are countries that are too big to sanction, too big to fight, essentially. And, you know, Vladimir Putin is in a very strong position because nobody wants this progress to a shooting war in any respect. And so you hear these kind of incredibly tragic statements from William Hague saying, we've suspended preparations for the G8. And you think, whew, that's going to show him. That's really some strong stuff there. But yeah, but there is very little that we can do.
I mean, is there very little we can do, or is there very little we're prepared to do? I think that's the question that I don't know the answer to. What are the factors that we're willing to risk, and what are our red lines? Would we send troops in?
I think there was an acknowledgement that when the EU expanded, it took certain kind of countries that had been in Russia's sphere of control traditionally under the Soviet Union, and, you know, the Balts being the classic example of that, but that its limits didn't quite reach as far as Ukraine. And that what we're seeing now is therefore a pushback. And, you know, Vladimir Putin will not let a good crisis go to waste. He saw an opportunity and took it. And, you know, we talk about this referendum that's coming up in the Crimea being absurd and unaccountable, but there is 50% of ethnic Russians in that region. It is not inconceivable that they would want their interests protected, and they would feel more closely aligned with Russia than they would with the rest of the Ukraine.
I guess the thing that sort of struck me over the past week from a kind of Westminster point of view has been the way that some conservatives wanted to link this directly to the stance that Ed Miliband took over Syria. You had Sajid Javid and Nick Bowles saying there was a direct link between Ed Miliband's decision not to support, well, he didn't even not support intervention in Syria, he just didn't support the vote that called for more exploration into possible intervention in Syria, and Putin's behaviour. Now, while that's not fair to make that direct link,
and it was slightly overblown and just made them look a little bit ridiculous. There is something interesting about the way Putin has probably read the general signals from the West over Syria, which suggests that there's an appetite now for anti-interventionism and maybe even a certain amount of isolationism, which makes him probably feel as though he can get away with a lot more than he could have done a few years ago. I think that's about as far as you can push that, though.
Yeah, I thought that it was noticeable that Say Javid went very quiet.
Yes, very quiet.
just slowly back away, let that one sit there, hope no one noticed. And I think you pointed out at the time that it's equally poor reflection on David Cameron, because, you know, he called a vote that he didn't know that he could win. He didn't win it. 30 Tory MPs rebelled against him, I think, something like that.
Yeah.
And then immediately after the vote, he went, well, in that case, I'm not doing anything else. I'm going home. And it wasn't an episode that he came out with huge credit. I mean, you had people saying at the time that would have almost in the past been seen as a vote of no confidence. What was amazing was that David Cameron shrugged it off with sort of seemingly no damage. But yeah, I think Isabel's right in that there is a signal very strongly coming, particularly from Barack Obama, that he doesn't want to be sorting out things on the edge of Europe. He's got kind of other things on. And therefore, that gives someone like Putin the license to push it much harder than they otherwise would have done.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, I think coming back to the point about Ed, it doesn't actually help the Tory Ed is weak narrative to give him credit for being the one person in the entire geopolitical world who means that Putin can now be emboldened to do this.
But the other thing I was really struck by, I was watching The Big Questions this morning as I was having my makeup done for TV, which I can't recommend to you enough if you want to, you know, really hear some kind of angry people arguing. But they had Jeremy Corbyn on, who's, you know, the long-serving Islington Labour MP, very strongly anti-war. He was making kind of very strong anti-intervention and, you know, bringing up Iraq, which is now, let's just forget, you know, a decade ago. And people were clapping and cheering. And I don't know whether or not the audience on The Big Questions are representative of anything much in particular. But that there was a huge appetite against intervention at the time of the Syria vote. 60%, I think, the public polling was on it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that any kind of squaring off with Vladimir Putin in any serious way would have any more support among the public. We are just, as a country, less up for just meddling in other people's affairs than we were even 10 years ago.
But we're still much more engaged on that issue. I just think it's really interesting. One thing I found really interesting around the time of the Syria vote is I'd go to a running club every week, and I go largely because people don't talk about politics, they just talk about their tempo runs and really boring things like that. But around the Syria vote, they were all asking me about what was going on in the Commons. Most of the time, they think my job's incredibly boring and they don't want to talk about politics at all. But it's just, I know that's very anecdotal, but it's just interesting how interested normal people with normal lives are in those questions as opposed to domestic issues.
Well, I think it's something that, you know, that everybody kind of feels that they can grasp and have an opinion on. And I think there's a thesis, I can't remember what the name of the book is, about the US presidency, which is essentially that US presidents go a bit mad, particularly in their second term, because they realise that they're thwarted so much by Congress, particularly if they've got a Congress from the other party. And they discover that the one place that they are really powerful is in foreign affairs. And that's the moment at which they're sort of starting to kind of, you know, itchy fingers on the deployment button comes out. And I think there's probably a certain amount of truth in that, as in a way that, you know, leaders do enjoy swanning around having big peace summits. And I think that David Cameron is not immune to that, even if realistically the UK's involvement in any kind of military intervention somewhere like Syria or even in Libya would be very small scale and limited.
Mm. I've just been reading the Andrew Lawnsley book, The End of the Party. I've just finished the Iraq section, and I think that really chimes with what he's, you know, it's not a party political issue. I think that you're right, this is a thing that leaders find, you know, particularly I suspect in a country like Britain, where we have a sense of ourselves that is possibly slightly more inflated than our realistic position in the modern world. We're not a superpower. We're not going to be a superpower. We're not a rising superpower. All the places that used to belong to us don't anymore. And they're the superpowers. So we're kind of, you know, I think we our sense of ourselves is overinflated. And yet that can be very much put to somebody's head when they go around, you know, having important discussions about, you know, war and peace and life and death. And, you know, that must be very, very difficult not to make you feel like it's your duty to intervene at every point.
Well, I think it's a rare case where you can, as a leader, say something, it is then done, and then an action happens immediately after it. And we've been talking about the kind of slow progress of bills through the House and kind of the way that we've got, you know, the legislation has got stuck. And this is the opposite of that. And so I can imagine that it must be very enticing to feel that you can ask for something to happen, it happens, and you see a tangible result very quickly, particularly as you face troubles at home.
The other thing that I think has been exposed by, if it hadn't been before, exposed by the Ukraine issue is the confusion amongst the anti-war left as to what they really are anti. There was a piece put out by the Stop the War Coalition, which was not stopping any war. It was, you know, supporting Russian action simply because it's, you know, not the West. And I found that, you know, really quite shocking, even by people I was already not a big fan of. Having been against the Iraq War, one of the things that was most discomforting to me was who some of my fellow marchers were.
Oh, well, I think there's a big problem on the left that it's got a very good critique of American imperialism, and it doesn't have such a well-developed one of Russian imperialism, certainly.
Yeah, Russian or China, anywhere that is not the West is therefore okay, whatever it is they do, and will support whatever it is they do. And I just find that, you know, A, disturbing, and B, not exactly setting ourselves up as ready for the coming century, where US may not be the biggest superpower.
Yeah, that kind of ambivalence towards emerging economies is interesting, because it suggests a sort of, I don't know, a certain amount of idealism, I think.
Well, and also a slightly patronising attitude to places which, you're right, that will be in 20 years' time probably much more geopolitically important than we are. And we still feel this sort of odd kind of paternalism about the kind of, well, you're only a country because we made you a country 100 years ago. and that, but again, this is all comes back to this, that where what Britain's sense of itself in the world is.
Yeah. Okay, I think we've probably covered Ukraine as far as any of us are going to be able to. I think we should note that although we've discussed this week the Lib Dem conference, they were in fact beaten in the by-election by the Bus Pass Elvis party. So I do hope that when Mark does next week's podcast, he does cover the Bus Pass Elvis annual conference. I hope he listens to this, and then I will probably get a very angry tweet. I want to take the time to thank Helen and Isabel for joining me today. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you.
And thanks also to Kevin McLeod from Incompetech.com for our funky theme music, and to Audioboo for hosting.